The impact of exercise on chronic medical conditions.
Insurance status and cancer care outcomes.
Can we control diabetes with mHealth?
And does more stays in the ICU mean better outcome?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on August 12, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we need to turn first to a journal we have never mentioned before, the Journal of Medical Internet Research. There's a good one. Looking at this issue of diabetes, I said, can we manage it with mHealth? Goodness, what in the world is that?
So kudos to you for finding this interesting article. The issue of mHealth, or in particular mDiabetes, refers to mobile health or mobile care of people with diabetes. This was conducted in India. They attempted to use mobile text messaging to improve behaviors associated with diabetes. From 1 million Nokia phone subscribers, they chose almost 1,000 participants who, over the course of 6 months, received about 56 text messages. They received one a day for the first week, and then two per week after that. And these were text messages to remind them to eat more fruits and vegetables, low-fat diet, and to exercise more frequently. And then from non-Nokia phone subscribers, they did nothing except to interview each of these groups at the beginning of the study and 6 months later to say, did your behavior change? And here's what they discovered. The use of mobile text messaging significantly improved the individual's behavior. They were more likely to eat more fruits and vegetables. They were less likely to eat high fatty food content. Unfortunately, it didn't affect exercise at all. And you say, well, how much did this cost? Well, that's the amazing thing. Over the course of 6 months, this is about 65 cents per person.
Pretty good stuff. And in my initial look at this study, one thing I thought was pretty compelling was the fact that these messages were tailored. They went out there and they said, hey, we're trying to intervene with certain groups of people. What's most likely to resonate for them when we send them stuff?
And so not only was it tailored with regard to the surveys, but also there were 12 different languages that the messages were given in as well. This is a great example of using mHealth or mobile health in a very cost-effective way applied to low middle-income countries where it affected a very good behavioral change.
And we know, of course, that cell phones are becoming ubiquitous all over the planet. One question I would have about these kinds of interventions is more long-term impact. And I just think about myself. If I were getting these messages, getting pinged, I start finding that a little annoying, and I might start discounting it. And in fact, I might even choose to be a contrarian and do it just because I want to spite that message.
Well, your point's well taken, but it's interesting because they not only showed improvement in the behaviors, but they showed there were fewer people less likely to get worsening behaviors in the people that received the text messages versus the control group. So it would be nice to extend it for a longer period of time, but I would say that if you've begun to affect behavior and it's lasted for 6 months, it's more likely to have a longer effect than if the study had only lasted for 2 to 4 weeks. And you're right, Elizabeth, there are over 3.6 billion mobile subscriptions across the world. So this has a lot of applicability.
I guess we're going to be seeing more from this journal. Let's turn now then to one that we talk about a lot more, the British Medical Journal, a favorite topic of ours, of course, physical activity and its multitude of benefits. And this, of course, is quite a large study.
On the one hand, you might say we're beating a dead horse, but really there are very few studies that actually look at the dose response association between total physical activity and reducing breast cancer, colon cancer, diabetes, ischemic heart disease, and stroke. So what this study did was look at over 36 years of data from different studies, trying to establish whether there was a dose response association, and if so, how much. And by the way, the thing that was really nice about this study is they didn't look just at leisure time activities. We're not talking about exercise in your off time, but they actually looked at total physical activity throughout the week. For example, we spend a lot of time, oftentimes either walking to work or cycling to work, or we may garden, or we may do household chores in addition to our leisure time activities. And furthermore, they quantified the amount of physical activity in terms of what's called METs, or metabolic equivalence. That is, how much energy you expend in that activity versus rest. The recommendation is that across the week, you spend 600 METs of activity. That's, again, about 150 minutes of walking throughout the week, 30 minutes a day times 5 days. What they found out was the higher levels of total physical activity were associated with significantly lower risk of all the outcomes. It decreased the risk of breast cancer by 14%, colon cancer 21%, diabetes by 25%, and the same for heart disease and stroke. Now, Elizabeth, if you and I tried to sell a pill that could do that, we'd be billionaires. And then what they discovered was the recommendations of 600 mets, well, you get some benefit, but you get the maximum benefit up to about 3,000 or 4,000 mets. That means doing five times the total amount of activity. You would say, how do you do that? I can't exercise five times as much. No, but you can walk to work for 20 minutes a day. You can cycle for 20 minutes. You can vacuum for 15 minutes. And you do all that, and suddenly you're at 3,000 mets. And by the way, if you go higher, there's a correspondingly less benefit. So you get most of the bang for the buck with that moderate amount of exercise and going really ultra high endurance, a little benefit, but not nearly as much.
Well, I like this study because that study we talked about last week where we looked at, well, how much do you have to do? I think all of these things are really helping inform us. And I hope that on the part of physicians are going to result in a specific prescription for exercise.
This would suggest you can do it in terms of total activity throughout the week, and you can quantify it at 3,000 to 4,000 mets. If you have the ability to do more walking or cycling to work, let's do that. Again, or more household chores, those kinds of things.
Very good. People could do what you do. They could put all those lights on their bicycles and look like they just landed from outer space. I mean, even if they're riding in the dark, right?
All the activity helps.
Exactly.
What do you want to go next, Elizabeth?
I think next we will go to the Journal of Cancer. This is a subject that really I find very concerning. These were two studies taking a look at, hey, for these two different types of cancers, let's look at outcomes. And were those outcomes affected by insurance status?
So the two types of cancer you're talking about is one is a brain cancer called glioblastoma multiforme, and the other is testicular cancer, what's referred to as germ cell tumors. And both of these studies use the same database. This is something called the Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results Program. It's an NCI database that looks at cancer and outcomes. The testicular cancer is particularly interesting because that usually occurs in individuals that are kind of in the 20 to 35 year old range. And we know that is one of the most underinsured populations in the United States. And what they found was that the outcome when people presented in terms of their cancer, usually later in the disease process, more metastasis and a worse prognosis was associated with your insurance status. If you had no insurance or Medicaid, you were likely to present later in the disease process. And unfortunately, your mortality was about 60 to 80% higher if you were uninsured than or had Medicaid versus being insured. And then they extended this same observation to patients with brain cancer.
What I thought was pretty compelling about both of these studies was the fact that they attempted to correct for a lot of confounders, a lot of other factors that would have potentially impacted on the results. So I think they really point to a problem.
You might say, well, I understand why being uninsured may make a difference, and we all wish it didn't. Here's the thing that's even more concerning, is those that had Medicaid had a poorer outcome than those that were insured. In fact, those that had Medicaid look like those that were not insured. And all we're doing with the Affordable Care Act is trying to get people on Medicaid. So that suggests to me that that may not be adequate to improve their outcome where we want it to be.
I guess this is really going to take some pretty high-level policy kind of things in order to rectify the situation.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is database material. It doesn't drill down and say exactly what all the issues are, except it did say that they didn't receive the same type of treatment. We need to make policy to make sure that the same standard of care is applied to all individuals, and it shouldn't depend upon what kind of insurance you have.
Finally, then, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine, a look at ICU use at the end of life.
I'm going to change the focus a little bit. There are some conditions that could be treated in an intensive care unit or can be treated on the hospital floor. Things like diabetic ketoacidosis, pulmonary embolism, or an upper GI bleed, or even congestive heart failure. Sometimes those patients are cared for on the hospital floor or the hospital ward, and sometimes they're transferred to an intensive care unit. What this study attempted to do by looking at 94 different hospitals in over 156,000 hospitalizations to determine what was the variability among ICU care, what was the variability in cost, and did it improve outcome? And here's what they found out. There was a 5 to 10-fold difference in whether the patients with these conditions received care on the hospital floor or whether in the ICU. Not surprisingly, those that were in the ICU had higher hospital costs per average between $700 and $3,000 per patient, depending upon the condition. They had more procedures. Their outcome was really not any better at all. When they looked at the medical conditions, they actually did not have higher comorbidities in the ICU than on the hospital floor. In fact, just the opposite. So that suggests that the things that drive people to the ICU aren't related to the patient, but is somehow related to the hospital preference. It's hospital-driven, not patient-driven.
That's really a very fascinating conclusion, isn't it? And so what does that suggest to you with regard to clinical management?
It suggests we don't have it right yet. We're not maximizing ICU care. We were driving up costs. We're adding more procedures. We're not improving care. I think we need to drill down.
No doubt we'll be hearing more about this one too. This week on the blog, I'm going to talk about diabetes and mHealth initiatives. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.